Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. As a teen in the 1980s, Ray Raghunath Kapo founded the hardcore punk band that came to be known as Youth of Today, which ironically championed the principles of clean living, vegetarianism, and self-control. This is not the image we might associate with punk rock. After experiencing a spiritual awakening in India, Ray formed a new band called Shelter, which was devoted to spreading a message of hope through spiritual connection. Our guest today is Ray Raghunath Kapo, author of the new book, From Punk to Monk, a memoir. Ray currently leads yoga retreats, trainings, and kirtans at his Super Soul Farm retreat center in upstate New York, as well as annual pilgrimages to India. He is the co-founder and co-host of Wisdom of the Sages, a daily yoga podcast that has been ranked number one on Apple for podcasts about spirituality. Well, hello, Ray, and welcome to the Pathway Show.
Great to be here. Honored to be here. Thank you.
So let's start with the obvious question. What led to your decision to leave your band in the punk scene of the 1980s New York City and take a one-way journey to India?
Well, and a lot of this, as you know, is explained in my book, what I was going through. But I think it's safe to say that if any of us have had any type of success in the workplace, sometimes we see those very things that we are attracted to or that we're good at, and we become successful at them. The very thing that we were passionate about sometimes becomes a little bitter. And sometimes people end up quitting the very thing that they were attracted to because things like competition, things like greed, things like envy, they creep up on us. And these are all the things I studied in my hobby when I studied books on spirituality, especially the books from India, the canon of literature they have in India. India doesn't have one holy book, as you know. It has canons of literature on self-improvement that are as old as time.
Right.
And so when I blended the insatiable or there's sort of the tasteless flavor of success in that workplace, so to speak, mixed with my father, who, if you read in the book, he goes into a coma for 3 years during the band, and then after 3 years, he leaves his body. And when you get something like that in your life, when you had some type of stability and you lose your stability through loss, through chronic disease, through perhaps maybe loss of all your finances or whatever it be. For me, it was a loss of a very steady man in my life, a stable person in my life. Then what happens is you start to question the stability of material existence. And I think it's safe to say if you're over 20, you might have experienced that already. But if not, it's coming. That's part of the material world. We lose some stability. Sometimes we get it at very young ages. Sometimes we get it in the prime of our life. But sometimes things that are very solid break away, and it makes us either a wreck or look inside, or maybe a combination of both. And that's sort of what happened to me, I felt. It drove me. It goaded me to a spiritual path. And so at 22, I quit the band. And
you realize that life is unstable and you are insecure. And that is kind of the nature of existence. I mean, in Buddhism, there's the law of impermanence. And we have a hard time with that because we don't want to die.
Right.
You know, we don't want to age. We're kind of like have a bias against change, because we have a conservative attitude towards it that, you know, we're afraid of what it might lead to. I remember when I was in my 20s. Oh, I love change. I thought, oh my God, this is fantastic. Who knows what's going to happen? I'm just going to hitchhike here, and I'm going to hitchhike there. I'm going to go to India. I'm going to explore the world. I'm not worried about a thing. You know, change is going to happen, and I'm kind of counting on it. I'm going to like surf the waves of change. But I think as people get older, they get more sedentary and more resistant.
Yeah. So,
is that what you're talking about? I mean, this stability, this lack of stability. I mean, is there any stability in life, Ray, for anybody?
Life is sort of like seasonal. You know, everything's in bloom, and then the flower dies and wilts very quickly. So no, the material world is like a sandcastle. And I think part of anybody's spiritual path and any spiritual tradition is that we analyze the seasons of life. We analyze the flower, the scent of the flower, the beauty of the flower, and the wilting of the flower, and learn not to take shelter of the flower or the sand castle, so to speak, because we understand that these things are not solid. Material existence is not solid. And when I keep on investing in this in the temporary, there is very little return on investment. And so the thinkers of cultures around the world, of wisdom cultures around the world, say, go inside to find some peace and hold on tight to that peace during any storm, and hold on tight to it even when things are great, even when things are flying high, because those two turn around on a dime. And this isn't good information. This is necessary information to keep peace of mind, especially in troubled times, in when we look around the world today and it seems like things are burning and the world's so divisive. These are important things to hold on to when people are suffering from mental crises and overwhelm and depression. These are really important message right now, is to learn some type of spiritual connection through all this. Go on.
Do you see us as having a greater level of anxiety and depression these days? I mean, is that obvious?
It's partly based in what's told to us and what's projected to us by the media. It's partly also due to the information age, where we get to hear a lot of different narratives of what other people are going through. It's the information age where I know where I can find out where every disaster in the world is happening, and disaster sells. And it's also the sign of the times that things can get really ugly real quick. And it can send waves, shock waves of anxiety, depression. People live a more insulated life. They don't spend time outdoors. They live in they work in cubicles. They're disconnected from nature. They eat processed, refined foods. And so I think it's natural that people shrink and get caught up in this neuroses and anxiety. It's very normal. And unfortunately, it's not normal. But it's very normal that this is the path we're taking. It's expected.
I think it's a function of the ego. You know, we get to a point where we're so identified with our possessions and our whatever we have control over that we just don't want to let go of it. Animals don't have that problem because their ego never gets evolved to that extent, I suppose. But
And my ego is not that evolved too. I'm working on it. I'm a work in progress.
Right.
I wish I was more enlightened. I feel like I put in a lot of work. But according to the yogis, they say, well, you've also put in lifetimes of work towards illusion as well. So I'm a black belt at illusion, and I'm trying my best to become a higher ranking belt in reality. And that's sort of my life's mission. And I feel like if I can direct myself and like a 12-step group, part of the healing of a 12-step recovery is a 12-step, you extend your hand and reach out to other people. And so part of our own healing is we share what we've got with other people. And that's what I tried to do with my years of being living a monastic life, was can I give that to other people? So because not everyone's going to be a monastic, live in a monastery, but they can. I'm sorry, go on.
No, but they can.
but they can, if I can just sort of translate into sort of codes and simplify what I've learned so they can apply it to their life, then maybe I can do some good in this world. And that's what I'm trying to do. That's what I tried to do with my biography, my autobiography. And that's what I want to do in my future books I'm working on.
So you lived a monastic life for how many years?
I lived a monastic life for 6.5 years. And in, and out of ashrams in America, Europe, and India.
Okay. And were you like celibate during all that whole time?
I was celibate during all of that. Yeah.
Okay.
Which is a tricky task. Which is a tricky task, I might add, when you're in your 20s.
Yeah, because there's a lot of testosterone competing for your.
There's a lot of testosterone, and yeah, yes. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah.
We can figure out the
rest. So what? Okay. Now this was your experience. You lived a monastic life for 6.5 years. Now you're married and have a family, right?
Is that right? I've raised 5 children, still raising them.
Okay. So you went, you know, after the monastic period, you became.
Yes, I guess the book should be called Punk to Monk to Householder with 5 kids and a farm and a retreat center. That should be the sequel.
Okay. That would be great. Okay.
It didn't end with monk. It went on to a griha, or a home life as well.
Okay, so the question I want to ask you has to do with what I'm aware of, having spent a lot of time in Asia and having, you know, spent time in monasteries in Thailand and Burma and other places, Sri Lanka. They have a tradition that the young man, instead of like going into military service, they go into the monkhood for a year. Huh. So they live in the monastery as a monk. And this is sort of like developing their character, I guess. But I'm asking you, what good did being a monk accrue for you?
Well, like the Greeks and like in Indian culture and a lot of Asian cultures, that was the goal of education. The goal of education was developing character. Nowadays, I can't say that I developed character in my public high school that I went to. Matter of fact, I probably developed the opposite of character. I learned how to be a dirtbag in high school. And it wasn't until I became thoroughly disgusted with my dirtbagness that I decided I don't want to be this guy anymore, that I entered into an ashram at age 22. So I didn't fall from heaven, not by a long shot. I grew up an American kid with American desires and passions, etc. But I got to a point where I just didn't want to be that guy anymore, and that's what made me change. And so, what I did do that. That time in the ashram helped me develop. Develop character for the best.
And how would you define character now that we've brought it up?
Thank you. I think character means you act from integrity instead of acting on whims. It means you're trying your best to control your senses, control your mind, not let your mind and your senses control you. You treat people like souls, like spiritual beings, instead of objects that I can consume. He's got money, so I'm going to be friends with him. She's hot, so I'm going to try to, get with her. You treat people like spirit souls, not like objects for consumption. And then you try to live a life where you're not using people, but you're giving back to people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now there's so many things that you've said in this book that are so profound, and
thank you.
About death or about addiction or about sex. I just love it. I mean, you cover a lot of bases here, freedom, you know, you about sex, you say, and I'm going to quote the book, "I also felt that sex could be addictive, degrading, and unsatisfying. It always left me a little lonely." Now, I assume this is pre-marriage. I had
it's
heard
not only pre-marriage, it's pre-monk. I was before
pre-monk.
I was 18 years old.
Okay. I had heard that all animals were sad after sex.
That's Thomas Aquinas.
Is that Thomas Aquinas?
That's Thomas Aquinas.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And you didn't know if it was true for everyone, but it was true for you. Okay. So you had sexual experiences that were emotionally disconnected, and it was disillusioning.
Sure.
You know, you saw that sex alone wasn't going to wasn't going to solve anything, but you were dealing with addictions. You know, I mean, sex is one possible addiction. And you say the senses always want more. This is what addiction is. Or somebody else said this, and you're quoting him. You're feeding the body. It's making you sick, addicted, broke, destitute. You still want more. The desires are never ending. The cup is never filled. In fulfilling the desires of the mind and the body only increases one's desires. This is so interesting because, you know, it's like the second noble truth, right?
That, yeah, exactly.
But I think the second noble truth is often mistranslated. It's translated to desire is the cause of suffering. And I think the real translation is more like craving or addiction.
Sure. It seems like fulfilling the desires will fulfill the desire. But in fact, it's like sort of blowing on a campfire. The fire goes down momentarily and then it inflames. So it does increase the craving. And thus, I guess if you were to analyze craving, I want, it means I want more. So that's why they say suffering comes, because it comes from I want, but I can't have. I Right. want, but I can't have.
Right.
So unlimited. So the Bhagavad Gita, but or the Buddhists will say that these unlimited desires, like a network of unfulfilled desires, leaves one in total anxiety. How can I get this? How can I fulfill this? How can I get? It's almost like a child in a candy store with a credit card, feeling like overwhelmed. You know, it's as they bring. If you have little children, you bring them to the Baskin Robbins, and you say, "Okay, what flavor do you want? We got 48 flavors here. Which one do you want?" The kid is ready to like lose his mind. He doesn't know. It's too much, and this is how we stay. And we think it's pleasure. It's not pleasure. It's actually anxiety. And so the great thinkers of time says, actually, it's in the control of the mind, in the control of the senses, that you actually find a deeper, more peaceful existence, not in the running around and trying to play whack-a-mole with all of your desires.
Right, right. Oh, that's such a good description, you know, because desire is actually in and of itself a good thing. If you don't have any desire, you're not going to ever make a move to do anything.
I agree.
Become enlightened. So
it's like, what are you going to desire though? That's the question. I love your point. It's like, it's not like we're trying to like bury desire. And the yogis would say by bury our nature, we're desiring people, but what are you going to desire? Like I desire to eat. So am I going to eat junk food, or am I going to eat food that nourishes me? I desire to be entertained. And is my entertainment going to be degrading or uplifting? Is my desire for friendship or dialogue, is that going to be degrading? I've had degrading dialogue, or is it going to be upgrading? So we always have this opportunity with our desires to repose them in something that uplifts our life or degrades our life. And we notice that, and we look at our life as an opportunity to grow or an opportunity to slide back down the mountain. And it's nice to analyze it like that, because it reframes our choices.
Ultimately, what difference does it make? Now, I want to talk about reincarnation for a second, because I just wrote an article for Maui Vision Magazine. I have a column in Maui Vision, yes. And I wrote an article on how my belief in reincarnation supported hope and what was the other one? It supported hope, the search for hope and meaning. And so, but I'm wondering what you think about that. I mean, what is your, not all Buddhists believe in reincarnation. Well, you're not a Buddhist, you're a yogi.
Yeah, I'm a yogi. A very vague word would be a Hindu.
Uh-huh.
Vaishnava would be more distinct name and worshiper of Vishnu. But yeah, we believe that the soul is this, we don't have a soul. We are a soul. And the soul has many, many desires, and we refine our desire by connecting with source. That is our main desire. Our meditation is on source or God or Vishnu. And in that meditation, we start to see everything else becomes sort of petty. We start to realize this won't give me the things of this world won't give me pleasure because I'm a spiritual being. It's not something artificial. We don't say, hate this and thou shalt not do this. We say, do whatever you want, But you're going to find spiritual activity make you joyful, and material activity won't fulfill you. I think it may be safe to say a lot of our listeners have already had that experience. You know, great bands have sang, "I can't get no satisfaction." That, and these are spoken by the people who could have anything they want, anybody they want, have all the money they want, and still they can't get no satisfaction. So the belief is that we keep progressing or digressing according to our activities. And our goal eventually is to evolve to this point where we're not even of the material world anymore. And that can happen in this lifetime, whereas in your next body, you don't even get a material body because you have no more material desires. So I'm just going to put a little caveat there. Some people might say, "I don't believe any of this bullshit. I don't believe any of it." Sorry if the censor that out, but I don't believe any of this stuff. Well, then at the very least, understand that if you can live a life in this world where you feel like I just have spiritual desires, what a joyous life you'll have anyway. So even if you don't believe in a pie in the sky when you die, if you live just these spiritual principles in this lifetime, you'll have a joyous life where you're not riddled by anxiety, where you take it one day at a time, where you treat each other with great dignity, great love, great respect. What a nicer way to live, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And we have, you know, the eight vicissitudes. I just interviewed a guy, Ethan Nickturn, who wrote a book on the eight vicissitudes. He calls it Confidence is the name of the book. And so he talks about how we're blown around by this, you know, polarity of pain and pleasure and success and failure and fame and insignificance. And, you know, we just have to learn how to manage that. But people get very addicted to that. You know, all these rock stars, you know, who can't get satisfaction, you know, of course, you know, but they can't stop lusting after their addictions.
Sure.
I think getting over addictions is not that easy. Maybe becoming a monk is the best thing to do. Become a monk for 6 years and you have a shot.
You know, if you do some strong internal work, anybody has a shot at it. But I will say, if you've been so-called blessed with good karma, that blessing can be a curse very well. You know, sometimes people who have all the beauty or all the wealth or all the fame, they get all the distractions and all the allurements of the material world, maybe, you know, tenfold or a hundredfold more than an ordinary guy like you and me who does, you know, we do our, you know, our writing and our, you know, our et cetera, what we do. But maybe we don't, if we had that better karma, it would be more suffering. So in the yoga system, I follow the bhakti yoga system. We say good karma, don't go after good karma. Good karma means better problems. If you want better is you get focused on source. We are spiritual beings. We are in this world, but not of this world. Get focused on source, and you'll be actually filled with joy. And if good times come, you're not attached. If bad times come, you're not attached. And that's our practice.
I think if I want to earn good karma at this point, which I do, I think I'm hoping that it'll give me some leverage with God. Please, can you send me somewhere other than Earth next time?
Well, the yogis say there's places much better than Earth. They say Earth is sort of ghetto.
You know, that makes sense to me.
That's what the Gayatri Mantra is, Bhurvaha Svaha. It means the middle planetary systems like Earth. Earth is somewhat in the middle, you know? You can have a great day, and you could also have the most horrific day of your life in 2 hours, right? Or you can have... And then there's higher planets, higher planetary systems, and lower planetary systems. Vedic cosmology is quite fascinating, as well as the study of the heavens and the medium planets and the lower planets. It's very interesting.
Well, we've only got about a minute left, and so I want to give you the opportunity to offer some nugget of wisdom for our audience in closing.
Nugget of wisdom.
or the best you can do.
All right. Well, I think we were talking about like return on investment. We talk about our net worth. Sometimes we have this word, that phrase we throw around, and we believe that our net worth is not our stuff. That is our net stuff. Our net worth is actually, our worth comes from us doing worthy activities. Our worth comes from living in this world as a giver instead of a taker. The stuff we have, this is just stuff that we are all going to lose. If we really want to have self-worth, we have to do worthy things in this world. If we really want to have self-esteem, we have to do esteemable activity. But to total up all my real estate assets and my bank balances and my CDs and my IRAs, et cetera, that's not our net worth. That's worth, you can have all that stuff and feel worth nothing. Real worth is how much have I given in this lifetime instead of how much have I accumulated? How about that?
That's beautiful, Ray. Thank you very much. That's a great note to close on. And I want to thank you for being with us today. There's so much more we could explore, but we have run out of time.
Thank you.
And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, www.raghunath.yoga. That's
R-A-G-H-U-N-A-T-H, Raghunath.
.yoga. Perfect.
Yeah. Thank you.
Find out all kinds of things about Ray's work there, as well as his how to get his book, which is available at Amazon and everywhere where it should be sold. Okay.
Punk to Monk. And we have a podcast, a daily podcast on all the things we're talking about now in spiritual life. We study the ancient books of India. It's Wisdom of the Sages, available wherever you get podcasts.
Wisdom of the Sages. I love it.
Thank you, my friend. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. And for those who may have tuned in to Pathways late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Intuitive Intelligence, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. Now, don't worry, you can play or share this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Ray Raghunath Kapo, author of Punk to Monk. And I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed on the internet at www.kboo.fm every Sunday morning at 8:30 USA Pacific time. And even better, podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. That's spelled divination.com, as well as via iTunes, Paulo's YouTube channel, and other free podcast servers looking for Pathways. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways radio and podcasts. And thanks again to Ray Raghunath Kapo and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.